Welcome to Urban Forum Northwest with your host, Eddie Wright Jr. We have a full program today. I want to start off by introducing Seattle Port Commissioner Fred Feldman. And I'm going to have Fred Feldman, my co-host for this segment of the program. We'll go ahead and take off right now and let folks know what he's doing and why he's doing it.
Well, thanks so much, Eddie. And thank you for giving us this opportunity to talk about International Holocaust Remembrance Day, which starts tomorrow. And I'd like to really thank you for all the work you do and your other programming as well. I begin to acknowledge and appreciate the work of here, Miri Cypress and Branda Anderson, my guests, for providing context for today's conversation. Miri is a regional director for the Anti-Defamation League's Pacific Northwest office based in Seattle, where she furthers ADL's mission to address anti-Semitism and all forms of hate and advance civil rights across the Pacific Northwest. Branda Anderson is the teaching and learning specialist for the Holocaust Center for Humanity. Branda previously taught world history and social studies at Kamiak High School in Mukilteo for 19 years. And so, the Port of Seattle passed a proclamation last year to say we should remember Holocaust Remembrance Day and recognize the importance of never forgetting. And so for me, my dad fought in World War II. And while I'm not a religious Jew, I'm a cultural Jew. And to me, you don't have to be either, or you don't have to even, be a strong supporter of Israel to take offense by any sort of discrimination, especially something as arbitrary as this. So I took on this effort, and it's really consistent with a lot of the other work our fellow commissioners have done in recognizing, in Black History Month and the discrimination and institutional racism that exists, and with Asian hate, and that's been going on as well, no less going back to the Muslim ban. And we've all rallied around these causes, and this is just very important that we do the same. But the day is to remember the liberation of the Nazis' largest concentration camp at Auschwitz, and total of more than 6 million Jews and other nationalities were slaughtered in this general effort. And Elie Wiesel, a Nobel Peace Prize winner, said, to forget the dead would be like killing them for a second time. And then I think the one other quote that I'd like to leave you with is Martin Niemöller, this I think is the broader context that I think is very important for today's discussion. First, they came for the communists, but I was not a communist, so I did not speak out. Then they came for the socialists and the trade unionists, but I was neither, so I did not speak out. Then they came for the Jews, but I was not a Jew, so I did not speak out. And when they came for me, there was no one left to speak out for me. And so we're here to stand with you, to join in this conversation, so we all are able to define what it is that we're talking about and provide that context. And I really appreciate Branda, you're going to give us the history to start off with.
Thank you, Fred. Thank you, Eddie, for having me on your show today. I'm very excited to be with you and your listeners. First, I'll give a little context. Fred alluded to the International Holocaust Remembrance Day is established on January 27th, which marks the liberation date of Auschwitz-Birkenau. It became an internationally recognized day in 2005 when the UN member states agreed to hold commemorative ceremonies to mark the liberation. And it has since grown. The goal of International Holocaust Remembrance Day is twofold. One is remembrance, as Fred alluded to keep the memory alive. And two is education. And that for me is where we jump in. So historian Doris Bergen has a quote that I think is incredibly important. She said, every society gets the political movement that matches the social concerns and frictions of that society. That defines how the Nazis rose to power and were able to, in their time in power, not only marginalize, but murder millions of people, 6 million Jews, as Fred said, and millions of other members of groups. The Nazi regime banked on people following laws. And what they were able to do is build a society in which public discourse and public policy based on exclusion and prejudice were normalized. One of the things that a lot of people don't fully understand about the rise of Nazis is that their policies dealt with the struggles of the time and attacked minority groups. The majority of people, the policies actually benefited. Hitler used it, what is known as America's model. Hitler was obsessed with how the United States had settled through that sort of very contentious construct of manifest destiny, the continent, and the American policy of expansion and exclusion, which obviously included the destruction of indigenous cultures, as well as the enslavement of Black Africans. Further, Hitler had, when they built the Nuremberg Laws, which were the laws that officially discriminated against the Jews in Germany, his lawyers studied American Jim Crow and segregation laws. They were obsessed with how the American model was working. We were the model of segregation in the world at the time that the Germans used. When one of the most interesting things for me is that the legal theorists in Germany at the time were very uncomfortable with the extremeness of the American segregation laws. In particular, you might be familiar with the concept of the one drop rule, that having one drop of whatever is considered African or Black blood made you subject to the laws of segregation. The German legal theorists at the time, the mid-30s, said that policy was too extreme to be accepted by the German populace. And so instead, when they were defining who was Jewish in the law, in the same way our laws define who was Black in America, they instead went back two generations, feeling that America was too extreme. And I think that's an important thing to understand as we talk through this narrative. Now, as a brief overview of the Holocaust, when we think of the Holocaust, we should think of it in really three stages, from 1933 to 1939. From 1933 to 1939, the Nazis normalized prejudice through public discourse, like I mentioned, and public policy in Germany in particular, marginalizing the Jews in particular, but also marginalizing political enemies like the communists, other perceived racial enemies like the Roma and Sinti, commonly known as the gypsies. I don't use that term because it tends to be pejorative, as well as homosexuals and other catch-all groups. That's the beginning stages, normalizing the fear of the minority groups. From 1939 to 1941 is when we see the growth of murder and mass destruction. 1939, September, Germany invades Poland. World War II starts in Europe. A couple days later, Britain and France declare war, and you've got a war in Europe. From that point on, the Nazis began their mass murder in a very slow progression through Poland and into Eastern Europe. Under a divide and conquer policy that pitted ethnic groups against each other, so the Poles against the Jews, Ukrainians against the Jews, what have you, in the areas that they controlled, the Nazis would begin the process of murdering Jews. From 1939 to 1940, we have the beating of ghettos. Many of you are familiar with that, with the ghettoization process. In 2 years, 500,000 Jews died in ghettos from starvation due to forced labor and food rationing. At one point in the Warsaw Ghetto, residents were allotted less than 200 calories a day for food. When I was in the classroom, I reminded my students that's less than their daily Starbucks. And so starvation and disease were the first mass murder plans of the Nazis. In the second phase of that time, from 1941 on, we have what's called the Einsatzgruppen, which is a very technical German term for essentially murder squads. In that time, members of the Einsatzgruppen went behind the military as the military expanded, rounded up Jews from local villages, and shot them. 1.5 million Jews died at the hands of the Einsatzgruppen. And as we see, there's this escalation. If you think of the phases of the Holocaust, the normalization of hate and prejudice, the teaching of the danger of the minority, and then targeting them for murder. What we're most familiar with and what our day tomorrow commemorates is the beginning of the death camps. And that starts in 1942. In 1942, the Nazis decide that the Einsatzgruppen are no longer efficient. It's taking too long. And they develop what we commonly call the killing centers. Those would be Hemlo, Belzec, Sobibor, and Treblinka. These camps were designed purely for murder. The average lifespan of specifically a Jewish person, but in some cases Roma as well, in those camps was about 45 minutes. More importantly, Auschwitz and Majdanek were killing centers and labor camps. So they were what we call the hybrid camps. And that is the beginning of the industrialized murder. It didn't start with Auschwitz, but it certainly ended with it. It started with the marginalization of a group in a society, the normalization of prejudice and hate. That becomes public policy. that becomes a feared group that leads to murder. And I'll end here with this kind of important concept. The Holocaust was not an accident or aberration. It occurred because individuals, organizations, governments made choices that not only legalized discrimination, but allowed prejudice, hatred, and ultimately mass murder to occur. I'm going to hand it off to Mary to kind of transition into her discussion on modern anti-Semitism.
Well, thank you, Brenda. That was really moving and disturbing, but such an important reminder for all of us to continue to familiarize and honor this kind of history. So I work for the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL, and we are one of the nation's largest organizations that addresses anti-Semitism and all forms of bigotry. And I want to build on what Brenda was talking about by reflecting on what we're seeing today in our society as we honor International Holocaust Remembrance Day. What do we see as we look out upon our communities? You know, where are we standing? What are we doing? And what I'm going to talk about today is how a lot of the societal norms and unraveling that I think that we saw in the 1930s and 40s during World War II, I think, you know, it can be ripe to make some of those comparisons when we look out on our communities today. And one of the really powerful teaching tools that we at ADL have is this pyramid of hate that Brenda and many other educators use to educate school groups and elected officials and law enforcement and all sorts of stakeholders on how do we slowly normalize these kinds of attitudes and jokes and behaviors and slights. And like a pyramid, the layers build upon each other and become more and more serious over time. So you have these really serious, you know, kind of scary behaviors and actions at the top. But I think it just goes to show you that, you know, a pyramid is layered and you can't have, you know, discrimination and systemic racism and different forms of widespread oppression without having these kinds of normalized attitudes in which prejudice and bigotry against many communities are deemed acceptable. So I know it's a little bit hard for listeners to maybe visualize that pyramid and what it looks like and how the layers build upon that. But I think really what we're seeing today is how hate has become normalized in recent years. And maybe what we thought was a little bit you know, more historical when it comes to anti-Semitism and other forms of bigotry is really becoming more normalized and mainstream. And I'll name, you know, a couple of data points that we work with at ADL because we really value how information and accurate data can inform action and policy. And one of the things that we've been doing at ADL is since 1979, we've been collecting reports from individuals in the communities and institutions about their experiences with anti-Semitism because, you know, law enforcement does collect some of this information, but it might not be the full picture of what's actually happening. So as a trusted organization with our community, we get reports. And last year, when we published our annual audit, we saw the highest number of anti-Semitic incidents ever reported to ADL since 1979, which is well over 2,500, almost 3,000. And those incidents are serious. They're, you know, vandalism, assault, harassment. We're seeing threats against Jewish institutions. So we're really seeing, I think, both people feeling a collective responsibility to speak out, but a really dark underbelly rising up and starting to become more widespread. I also, you know, one of the recent pieces of research that we put out was a public opinion poll surveying the American public. And what we found is since 2019, which is just a few years in recent memory, anti-Semitic attitudes have nearly doubled, with many people in the population believing a number of anti-Semitic tropes that have been ever present throughout our history. And, you know, when we originally started doing this kind of attitude research, you know, post-1940s, 50s, 60s, we started seeing much more acceptance and respect for the Jewish community and a sense of belonging. And I think it's just really illustrative of this like scary backsliding that we're seeing. And in terms of how powerful, you know, discrimination and biased attitudes can really become. And I guess I'll just maybe close with like two last points. You know, I think as a person who identifies as a white Jewish person, I move through the world with a lot of privilege. You know, I don't have a talk with my kids about policing and what happens if they're pulled over by the cops. And I think about that because we are in this huge, hugely important period where we're post George Floyd having massive conversations about race. So on the one hand, I really recognize how my white privilege has played into the person I am today, to the sense of, you know, entitlement that I feel in certain spaces. And then on the other hand, I also walk into synagogue and it's heavily armed. I send my kids to Jewish preschool and it's heavily armed. I've heard of threats to Jewish day schools and institutions. I go to my office. I have, you know, a very intense security system. I've been personally targeted because of my work at ADL by neo-Nazis who have been federally charged with hate crimes. So it's this kind of weird balance, I think, with the Jewish community today in this, you know, racial reckoning of like finding out who we are. And I think having to better explain the nuances of Jewish identity and the history of where we've been and where we are today. So I think I just wanted to walk your listeners through that because I think the power of personal experience is really important. And, you know, I kind of dread the day where I'm going to have to explain to my kids why there are armed guards outside of our synagogues and our schools and our cultural centers. And it's just a really powerful, I think, reminder of the vulnerability that we as Jewish residents, you know, community members, et cetera, in the US are facing. But the only other thing I want to say, Eddie, because it looks like you want to jump in, is that, you know, as maybe some aspects of anti-Semitism are unique and we, like every community, has a unique history and a unique identity, you know, our theory of change and why we do what we do is the theory that we're all connected and that, you know, rising tides are going to lift all. And if one community is vulnerable and being oppressed, we are all, you know, potentially going to be vulnerable and oppressed. So I think that notion that we're talking about anti-Semitism today is so important. And sometimes it is left out of the conversation and it is so tied to what we're seeing. And I think the conversation around allyship and solidarity is so critical in recognizing how fragile, you know, our country is at this moment and the necessity of building community and relationship and empathy for one another. So I will leave you all with that.
Okay, that's great. We have about a minute left. I want to go back to the commissioner and have him wrap things up. What's going to happen during the Friday the 27th is International Holocaust Remembrance Day. Is there any plans, activities, anything that people can see online or somewhere else that interested?
Well, I will leave it to them to close on that. I just want to make sure people are aware that on the 24th of January, we did pass this proclamation that basically calls for incorporating training and education in the port so that, you know, we can, if you see something, say something, and understanding what that really means. So that's what we have incorporated. I also encourage folks, if they want to get a little bit more in detail on how entrenched our own United States was in support of this effort, a Major Matto show on called Ultra really talks about how incredibly racist our country ourself was and not getting into the war and all these other things. And then, of course, Ken Burns' show, you know, like 6-part series on the Holocaust. But the whole first part of it is all about, you know, United States complicity in that. But for folks who want to do something tomorrow or the weekend, what's in store? To, folks have events going on?
Go right ahead.
We have an event tonight at the Museum of Flight, the Boeing Museum of Flight here in Seattle called Holocaust by Bullets that you can look at the HolocaustCenterSeattle.org for information on that.
Okay, thanks much. And Merrick Cypress, thank you very much. And Commissioner Fred, thank you. Putting it in. David, thank you for organizing it, brother. We really appreciate you. So I'll be talking to you guys real soon. The next part might be really interesting, talk about the Black soldiers who were fighting the Nazis and liberating Jews from the death camps. So we're going to take a break, Eric, and come back with our next guest after this.
Why sit in bumper-to-bumper traffic when you can hop on Link Light Rail and fly by the gridlock? it's a smoother, easier, stress-free way to get where you want to go. Whether you're heading north to Capitol Hill and the University of Washington, or south to Columbia City, Tukwila, and the airport, Link Light Rail will get you there quickly and safely. And if you have an ORCA card, even better. Just tap on the yellow card reader when you get on and listen for the beep to let you know your card has been accepted. Then tap your card reader again once you've reached your destination and listen for the double beep to let you know you've tapped off correctly. To find the closest Link Light Rail station or to learn how to get an ORCA card, just go to soundtransit.org and type Link Light Rail into the search bar. Sound Transit's Link Light Rail. Just another way that Sound Transit is powering progress.
Hi, my name is Mian Rice, the Diversity of Contracting Director for the Port of Seattle. As a public agency, the Port of Seattle serves the community, and our investments should benefit everyone who lives and works here. The Port is committed to equity, diversity, and inclusion, and to leveling the playing field. That means continuing to open doors to contracting opportunities to all, especially women and minority-owned and disadvantaged businesses. How can you participate? List your business in Vendor Connect, a database of contractors. Attend Port Gen workshops to learn how to do business with the port. Learn more about contracting opportunities at portseattle.org. For more information on operating a concessions at Seattle Tacoma International Airport, visit lease.ctacshops.com.
Need help getting started with self-help? You came to the right place. Alternative Talk, 1150.
All right, sounds like Stevie Wonder. Thanks, Irv. We appreciate that. We're back at Urban Forum Northwest. Let me say, first of all, Urban Forum Northwest is brought to you by the Port of Seattle's Diversity and Contracting Office, Sound Transit's Civil Rights Office for Equity and Inclusion, and the City of Seattle's Purchase and Construction Services Office. Want to give both folks a shout out. I appreciate them. So my next guest is Dr. Quintard Taylor. As most people up here in the Northwest know, he is the founder of BlackPass.org. And he and I were having a conversation. I started doing a little research and found out that Black soldiers played a significant role liberating Jews from concentration camps in Holland, in the Netherlands, in other places. And some of the folks that we've been looking up, and like Dr. Taylor said, you know, the Army has no record that they were ever there. Well, I posted some pictures on my Facebook page of them being there. Okay. So I want to make sure that myth is destroyed. But the 761st Tank Battalion was highly favored by the folks they were liberating. So Dr. Taylor, I'd just like to have you know, some people don't have any idea that Blacks played such a profound role in liberating people and fighting the battles against the Nazis and liberating Jewish folks from the death camps. So I'd just like to have your perspective on that, sir.
Well, I don't know if I can add much more than what you've said, but what you've said is pretty much correct. First of all, let me back up and say that there were at least 200,000 African-American soldiers who were in Europe. They fought in every area of Europe. As a matter of fact, we're working on a project right now to bring attention to the 92nd Division, which was the old Buffalo Division, which was kind of the legacy of the Buffalo soldiers, the earlier Buffalo soldiers. And they were instrumental in liberating much of northern Italy. And of course, the same thing happened in northern France and Germany. As a matter of fact, Black soldiers were some of the first to move into what was at that point Nazi Germany. And of course, that brings us back to your point about the liberation of the death camps. I don't know if we can quantify the number of Black soldiers who were involved in the liberation of the various camps, partly because of what you said before. The Army didn't keep records of this. The Army, and that's what's surprising to me, because the Army normally keeps records of everything. But as you also indicated, the 761st Tank Battalion was broken up into smaller units, and they were assigned to different capacities. And they were involved, we know, in the liberation of at least one death camp. But I think where the evidence becomes palatable is when you go back and look at and talk to the survivors. And when I say the survivors, I mean, on one hand, the people who were in the camps, and on the other hand, the people who were part of the liberation. And what's interesting about this is that there is documentation, there's documented evidence of Jewish survivors of the Holocaust, survivors of the camps, talking specifically about Black soldiers being part of the liberation force. And in fact, describing them graphically, because many of the Jewish concentration camp victims had never seen Black people before. And so the very idea of African Americans as soldiers and African Americans as American soldiers was a shock to many of them. On the other hand, there were individual Black soldiers who talked about their role in liberating the camps. But again, the problem is that there is no official record of this. There's no we can talk about eyewitness accounts, a number of eyewitness accounts, but we can't see that those eyewitness accounts verified in the records. And that says to me more about the racism of the U.S. Army at the time than it does about what actually happened. We know what happened. What is intriguing to me is why what happened seemed to be erased from the public record and from historical memory. And only now are we beginning to go back and try to recreate that memory and recreate that history.
Well, Dr. Taylor, I want to let our listeners know, if you really are interested in Black History Month, starts next week. And here's a part of history that's been buried. That's why I posted some of the pictures on Facebook. You can go online and read about the contributions of African-American soldiers in World War II. That's why I actually posted some pictures up of these Black troops who were right outside of some of the death camps. And there's also, I guess, one gentleman said that he had, like you said, never seen a Black person. He said, but I'm so happy to see that Black man raise up out that tank because we just got free. But the whites in America did not want to have anything to do with sounding letting people know about our participation, which is sad. And from the past administration, you know, it's one of the things is we really find out exactly how many people of that ilk are still around. And you're talking about at least 35% or better. And it's amazing how some people are able to do anything in this country and walk free. Trying to overturn the United States government is a pretty serious issue. I know I told you we're going to talk about something else, but I had to put that in there. Other group that I was reading about, they were called the Black Panthers. And that was the first group of Black Panthers. And they were over there as well, freeing prisoners of war from the death camps, I should say. So, Dr. Taylor, what do you think we can do to, Governor DeSantis would say this is critical race theory, if you tell the truth about African-American participation in the development of this country, even though my daughter, Angela Rye, says we built this joint for free. 254 years of slavery will attest to that. But what do you think we need to do to make sure that the truth gets out about the participation of Black folks in this country?
Well, I think we need to do what you're doing right now. You're talking about it on radio. And I will say one thing that there is, and I won't get into it now. If you want me to send you the list, I will. But there is a long and growing list of books and articles that talk about African-American participation in World War II. And interestingly, talk about the presence of Blacks in Germany and the presence of Blacks in concentration camps. So just as an aside, this is not directly related to what you're discussing, but I taught history for a long time at a number of institutions, including California Polytechnic State University in San Luis Obispo. And I personally brought to my class, to my history class, a survivor of the concentration camps. He was living in a place called Santa Maria, which is about 30 miles away. And we were able to arrange for him to come to the class. This is back in the 1980s, so it's some time ago. And I sat there mesmerized because I assumed that he was going to talk about Jewish survivors, because we, you know, that was the focus, the Jewish people who were in the concentration camps. And he said, did you know about the blacks who were in the camps with me? And that was mind blowing to me. No, I didn't know anything about the blacks who were in the camps with him. And he started talking about the various groups. And of course, fast forward to today, there are books now that are out that talk about the blacks who were victims of the Holocaust. They were Afro-Germans in many instances. They were also people who were in Europe who were swept up in the Nazi conquest and ended up in the various concentration camps. And so when we talk about the concentration camps, let's understand that there were a lot of people who were considered dangerous to Nazi Germany who were swept up into those camps, many of whom didn't survive. We've got profiles of some of these people on Black Pass, including the profile of one person who was actually Black and Jewish who ended up in the concentration camp. So there's a lot of history out there that needs to be exposed, and you're doing that job. You're helping to do that job with this program by talking about these kinds of topics. And as I said before, the one thing that I think is good that offers me, I guess, encouragement is the fact that the truth is coming out now, that more books, more and more articles are being written that talk about not just the role of Blacks in liberating camps, but the much larger role of Blacks in World War II, and the presence of Afro-Germans, of those people of African ancestry who were in Germany, who had to deal with the Nazi Holocaust. We just profile. I'll make this point, and then I'll stop, Eddie, because you know I talk
too much. No. You're talking just right. Go right ahead.
But we just recently posted an entry on a fascinating individual whose German name I will not attempt to pronounce, but he was an Afro-German, and he was killed by the brown shirts in 1932 in the street fighting that was going on. Some people may know that before the Nazis came to power, there was a struggle for power between the communists, mostly on one side, or certainly people on the left, and people on the right. And this person was one of the leaders of the left resistance to the Nazis. And of course, because he was a leader of the resistance, he was eventually killed. And now there's a monument to him in the city in Germany where this took place. There is recognition of what he was doing because he was part of the first resistance to the Nazis, the resistance even before the Nazis took power. So there's a lot of history out there that needs to be brought to light. And we will continue to do this. You will continue to do this. Maybe you'll have a program on some of these folks who were, you know, Afro-Germans who were caught up in the Nazi, what I call the larger Nazi Holocaust.
Well, I'll tell you what, Dr. Taylor, we'll have to have you on to talk about it. You're the expert on that one. But, you know, in looking at this stuff, the Germans had some propaganda they were putting out. And it was saying, this is to the colored soldiers. Why don't you like Germans? When you go home, you can't go to a white church. So, and we know that they were Black folks in the camps was getting slaughtered as well. We know that. As well, I think my earlier guest, Brenda Anderson, had made a good point about that. And I want to let people know, too, that 2 hours or so after this radio program, this edition of Urban Forum Northwest will be accessible on Alexa and also my podcast. Then the programs are archived on my website, urbanforumnw.com, for a year. So it's not just a one-shot deal. It's a 24/7 thing in a couple of hours. But in terms of getting the word out, is there going to be a major problem of educators following Rick DeSantis's edict about not having African-American studies anywhere?
You're asking me?
You're down there with Greg Abbott, so you probably
Yeah, I can say a lot about that. I talk about the so-called Texas Revolution, the Texas War of Independence. And I talk about the contradiction there that essentially Anglo-Texans were fighting to break away from Mexico in order to continue the enslavement of Black people. And of course, exactly. We know that Black people in Texas, to a large measure, including people right here in the county that I'm in right now, fought with the Mexican army because they understood that the Mexican army was an army of liberation. But that's another story. I guess to answer your question, what I just explained to you, which is the truth, is now considered heresy in Texas. And I'm not even sure I would be invited to say what I've just said to you in public schools in Texas. And that's how bad the situation is. But I think there are a lot of people who are pushing back against that. And I've already heard that there are going to be lawsuits against DeSantis's attempt to try to shut out African-American history. I mean, this is an inevitable march. You can't stop. And I want to be careful with my words here. It's not that you can't stop African-American history. You can't stop the truth.
That's okay.
You can't stop the truth.
Well, the truth lives in Florida, and his name is Benjamin Crump. And he's filing a suit against Governor DeSantis.
Right.
On the African-American studies issue. So, yes.
And of course, one of the things that I don't mean to sort of tout Black past, but as long as we have institutions like websites like Black past, it's going to be impossible for some legislature or some governor to say there's an erasure. We're going to order the erasure of Black history. Black history may not necessarily be taught in the classroom in a formal sense. But as you know, Eddie, you and I are old enough to know that before, 1969, Black history wasn't taught in the classroom anyway.
That's right.
It was taught in churches.
In church, at home.
Programs. Okay. It was taught in a whole host of places. And now we have the ability through the internet with programs like Black past to make sure that history is not erased. Yeah, unless there's a way to pull everything off the internet, and I don't think that will ever happen. Unless there's a way to pull everything off the internet, there's far too much history out there for anyone, any politician of any political stripe to say, no, we're not going to allow this kind of history to be taught.
Because Clintar Taylor, I want to thank you very much for your time today. We'll have you back on because you always have, you got all the research down, you got blackpast.org, and people need to know how they can access the information. So I want to thank you today. My next guest is King County Council, Martin Luther King Jr. County Council member, Rod Dombowski. And he got his Martin Luther King lapel button on, as you can see. And he has joined the council in February 2013. And he is vice chair of the committee with the money. And he's also done some very historic things with the environment. So welcome to Urban Forum Northwest, council member. Why don't you just start out by giving our listeners a couple of minute overview of who you are, where you came from, and what your priorities are.
Well, thank you so much, Eddie. And I've really enjoyed the previous conversations, including the one with Dr. Taylor. It's always fascinating and educational to hear him. And would let folks know, learning about Black history and Black soldier history. Several years ago, I was over in France for a visit, and I visited the American Cemetery, the Meuse-Argonne Cemetery, and there's a number of World War I veterans buried there, and there's thousands of crosses. One cross caught my attention. It had gold lettering on it, and I went up and read the name. It was the name of Freddie Stowers. And he was a Medal of Honor recipient, it noted on the cross, Freddie Stowers, S-T-O-W-E-R-S. So I did a little research. Freddie Stowers was an African-American soldier in World War I. He was deprived of the Medal of Honor despite his heroic acts in the waning days of the war. But 76 years later or so, then President Bush, the first one, awarded him the Medal of Honor, and also additional research after congressional action was conducted to see who else was left out. And so for your listeners who are interested in that part of history, it's a pretty compelling story of justice delayed and ultimately not denied, but certainly delayed and denied, I think, to many of his family, but worth checking out. So thanks for having me on. It's a privilege to be with you. Thank you for your decades of leadership, getting MLK Jr. Way named. And I saw you last weekend when we were doing the Bill Burton street renaming at the Rainier Vista Boys and Girls Club. I represent North King County on the county council. Be almost 10 years on February 11th will be my 10th anniversary. That includes Northeast Seattle, Shoreline, Lake Forest Park, Kenmore, Bothell, and parts of Kirkland. I chair the Transportation and Economy Environment Committee and vice chair of the Budget Committee. And I just really appreciate the chance to come on and talk about what the county is doing and what's coming forward this year.
Well, let's talk about the priorities for the county for this year. I know that there's been a lot of publicity about, I guess, the conditions in the jail and the whole issue about inmates with mental conditions and stuff like that. I don't know where that is, if that's on your radar, but we can start talking about the responsibilities you have as chair and vice chair of the two committees that you serve on.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the jail and the behavioral health challenges there. Some would say that our jail, we run one in downtown Seattle and the RJC in Kent, as well as the youth jail up on Capitol Hill. But some have said that our jails, Eddie, are the number two biggest, second size in the state for folks with mental health challenges in jail. Many of them should not be there. They should be getting care and not jail. And we just don't have in our state adequate beds and adequate resources to date. So one of the things we're going to do this year is we're going to take action on that. I think on Tuesday, the county council will vote to put on an April ballot, a measure to have a major investment in our behavioral health crisis system. Right now, if you need crisis care, if you're having a mental health challenge, it's really hard to get it anywhere in the county. So we want to build 5 crisis care centers around the county, including one just for young people, where you can walk in and get the care you need, where folks from the community can take others. So police aren't always the first response, you know, and jail. That'll be on the ballot in April. It's a 14.5 cents property tax request, but it would bring over 9 years about $1.2 billion to this cause to help address that and get folks care that they need rather than jail. We know if we make those upstream investments in housing and behavioral health supports, education, jobs, that it really pays off. And so we've got a lot of work, you're right, to do at the jail. We're understaffed over there. That's one of our big problems. I think like a lot of organizations, even Metro Transit, we're having trouble hiring enough folks. I encourage folks to come apply, work for the county. We need you. We've got jobs in almost every line of work here, but we need additional staff. And that's been a challenge in the jail. We reduced our population quite a bit during COVID. From about 1,800 or 1,900 people per day on average down to about 1,300 or 1,400. It's come back up and it's stressed our system. And we've definitely got more work to do over there. So I talked about that Behavioral Health Institute or effort. One of the things I've been working on last year and I hope to see launched this year is called an Equitable Development Initiative. I have a real concern about kind of gentrification and displacement. People with big dollars coming into communities, buying up land, you know, forcing longtime residents out. I know you've seen this over and over again. And I think government has an obligation to work for everybody to preserve communities and let people grow where their home is, you know, and develop where their home is. And so the city did something similar. We've got a county initiative that we've launched. We've got some recommendations that are going to come out. And it's really about making investments in community that need investments for economic opportunity, for housing, for jobs, and supporting folks and letting them decide what the right investments are, rather than somebody like me from North King County telling somebody in Columbia City or Skyway what ought to be done. I think it's our job to bring the resources and let them make the investments, make them the decisions. So that's my Equitable Development Initiative. I'm pretty excited about that. I want to get it launched. Finally, this fall, we've got renewal of our Veterans, Seniors, and Human Services levy. And that's a levy that, so you're talking about veterans issues. It's been very popular with voters. We have the best veterans program here in the country. If you're a veteran and need some help, we can help you at the county, even if the VA can't, or a federal government can't. I encourage you to reach out. It also makes major investments in affordable housing. And senior centers. So that's coming up and that'll be a big piece.
Can we get some information on that program specifically? Because I deal with a lot of the veterans, some are disabled, and I won't say anything bad about the VA because they're doing what they can, but there needs to be more done. This seems like anything for veterans, you know, once they put their butts on the line for the country, they come back, they get treated like third class citizens. It's really unfortunate.
Definitely. I would encourage anyone with interest there and go to kingcounty.gov/veterans. I've spent a lot of time on it. My dad's a Korean War veteran. He's 94, still lives at home in Renton. I grew up in, yes, where I'm from. I grew up in Renton. I went to Dimmitt Middle School in Skyway and graduated Hazen High School. And my dad's still there. And he, like I said, he was a veteran. And so I've had a particular interest in our veterans issues. But if you are a veteran, kingcounty.gov/veterans, We can help you with cash needs, housing needs, job opportunities. We've got an office in Tukwila by the mall, by South Center. And we've got one up at Northgate, right near the light rail stop. And you can call my office as well, 477-1001, or Councilmember Zahalai, if you're in his district, 477-1002.
Well, that's right. Yeah, promote your colleague there, because I think he have a lot of veterans in his district. I know that. So that's good to hear that something is being done at the county level. So sure. What are you working on, and what is your wish list for this year to get accomplished as a council member?
I really want to see that equitable development initiative launched, and not with just a little bit of money, but with real resources. We've worked with community to listen to what the community needs are, and they've got draft recommendations. They're going to be coming over. And now it's my job as a budget writer to find the dollars to make the investments that they say are needed. And so I'm going to be spending a lot of time on that. And I just think it's a really big opportunity, Eddie, to bring county dollars. And our budget for over 2 years, we are a big government. It's over $16 billion, the county budget. Bigger than the city of Seattle, bigger than a lot of states. The county is a little bit of a hidden government. Sometimes people don't think about it or remember it. We don't have all the visibility of the city. But there are, I encourage folks to think about when there's need or they need some help. Think about King County. We're a big budget, $16 billion, 16,000 employees, huge operations in transit and wastewater treatment, criminal legal system, of course, but human services and housing, environmental protection. We do a lot. And if folks have some needs, I encourage them to reach out. I want to get that EDI initiative launched. I'm also very concerned about the status, Eddie, of our Civil Rights Commission. And I'd love to have a dialogue with you on this. It's been anemic and almost non-functional now for a number of years. And I worked with former Councilmember Gossett in his final year. We co-sponsored legislation to strengthen and renew the King County Council's Civil Rights, or the King County Civil Rights Commission. And it got, frankly, delayed because COVID hit. And is really stalled out. But right now, and this is a very sad thing to say, and I'm frustrated about it, King County does not have a strong, proactive, and engaged civil rights commission. Martin Luther King County. It's unacceptable. So I'm working with the executive on that legislation to fine-tune it, bring it back. I want to get it passed. We ought to have a robust civil rights commission that is advancing those issues, that's bringing them forward, that's keeping us on our toes, that's being responsive to folks. Of all places in the country, Martin Luther King County ought to have it. And that's a priority for me in 2023.
Along that line, what about, what is the participation level? You know, I've had affirmative action for 23 years, and a lot of agencies assumed that was okay to legalize discrimination again. We got a report from the Office of Minority and Women Business Enterprise from the state of Washington for 2021, African-American-owned businesses did 0.18% of the state's business, 0.18. Yes. The state's procurement agency, the Department of Enterprise Services, the procurement arm in 2022 or 2021 didn't do 1% with all women and minorities. So I'm saying, you know, then you see this no affirmative action for 23 years and then no action for the last few years. And, you know, we've heard a lot of promises about things that are going to happen. I know that they might say no affirmative action, but I think as far as I'm concerned, discrimination is illegal as well. So how's the county doing in terms of bringing about equity?
I thought you might ask about that, and I apologize for not having the stat. But first, let me start by thanking you for your leadership, particularly at the Port of Seattle, to make them a very more responsive government and get folks with the need opportunities hired and on those jobs. They're a wealthy government like us. We have our office called Small Contractors and Suppliers Office, right? And you can be certified. If you have a business, you want to do work for the county, we will work with you, consult with you, train you, and get you certified as a small contractor and supplier, which is kind of the what followed I-200, as you know. Yeah. In 2018, I sponsored some legislation to help in the job space here with a priority hire bill. Priority hire says for contractors doing work on county projects, we want you to go and recruit in communities that have been left out of the economic success of this county, where folks are left behind, and bring them into the trades and bring them onto the job and hire them onto the contract. So hire that minority-owned architectural firm. You know, hire that minority-owned welding shop. And we set goals. For example, in the legislation I wrote, we want, if you've got 28% or residents at or below 200% of the federal poverty level, it applies. Or where 70% of the residents over 25 don't have a college degree, it applies. So we make our contractors go in to the community with this priority hire program and recruit affirmatively, and then we monitor and measure it. And I got to say, we've done fairly good on some of our projects. Other projects could have done better. And so it's a constant process, as you know, to keep the light shined on it.
And Congressman, we're just about out of time, but I want to say that I-200 opened the door. But your former county executive and governor, Gary Locke, killed affirmative action when he issued Governor's Directive 98-01 in December of 1998. That's what killed affirmative action. Thank you very much for your time today. And we're going to continue this dialogue. If you got something, please let us know, because I like to keep my listeners informed of what's happening from the people who are the experts in the field. So I want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll be in touch. We'll want to work with you.
I'm here for you.
Okay. Thank you, Bree. Appreciate that.
Take care.
Okay. Okay, Eric, we'll go ahead and take this break and come back after that.
Hi, my name is Mian Rice, the Diversity of Contracting Director for the Port of Seattle. As a public agency, the Port of Seattle serves the community, and our investments should benefit everyone who lives and works here. The Port is committed to equity, diversity, and inclusion, and to leveling the playing field. That means continuing to open doors to contracting opportunities to all, especially women and minority-owned and disadvantaged businesses. How can you participate? List your business in Vendor Connect, a database of contractors. Attend PortGen workshops to learn how to do business with the port. Learn more about contracting opportunities at portseattle.org. For more information on operating a concessions at Seattle Tacoma International Airport, visit lease.ctacshops.com.
Why sit in bumper-to-bumper traffic when you can hop on Link Light Rail and fly by the gridlock? It's a smoother, easier, stress-free way to get where you want to go. Whether you're heading north to Capitol Hill and the University of Washington or south to Columbia City, Tukwila, and the airport, Link Light Rail will get you there quickly and safely. And if you have an ORCA card, even better. Just tap on the yellow card reader when you get on and listen for the beep to let you know your card has been accepted. Then tap your card reader again once you've reached your destination and listen for the double beep to let you know you've tapped off correctly. To find the closest Link Light Rail station or to learn how to get an ORCA card, just go to soundtransit.org and type Link Light Rail into the search bar. Sound Transit's Link Light Rail. Just another way that Sound Transit is powering progress.
Exploring new territory every day. This is Alternative Talk 1150.
All right, Eddie Wright Jr. back at Urban Forum Northwest. I really want to thank my guests today. They did an outstanding job. Friday is International Holocaust Memorial Day. Remembrance Day. Let me get that right. And I want to thank Commissioner Fred Feldman, the Port of Seattle. I want to thank Brandy. Did I say her name wrong again? Ms. Anderson, and always Mary Cyphers from the Anti-Defamation League. And also want to thank the Port of Seattle's Civil Rights Office, Diversity and Inclusion. Want to thank the City of Seattle's Purchase and Construction Services Office, and me and Rice, Lawrence Coleman, and Josie Reagan at the Port of Seattle's Diversity and Contracting Office. But I think it's really important for people to do a little research and look up and see how much of our history has been left out. And there's a lot of things that African-American soldiers did in World War II to liberate Jews from death camps. Unfortunately, the Army didn't see fit to keep any records on Black participation because we had segregation here during World War II. And we just a step above that when you look at the economics of the situation. Anytime one group is getting 0.18%, that's just a step above apartheid. So hopefully the folks down in our state capital do the right thing, put a little pressure on where it needs to be to make sure that everybody is treated fairly and equitably. I'm not asking you to take somebody that can't do the job, but if you can't get on the job, you can't do the job. So once again, I really do want to thank my guest today. And thank you very much, Eric. And you have a good weekend, and I'll talk with you next week.